You are now listening to The Scheist Podcast, when millions of opinions just aren't enough.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Scheist Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Scheist. Thank you so much for being here. I've got a very special episode lined up for you today, but before we get the episode started, please take a moment to follow and subscribe to the show to make sure you never miss an episode. It really helps the show grow and lets me keep bringing you the best show possible. Now, you may know that this show started as an interview show, and it was one of my favorite things to do. It's still one of my favorite things to do, so I made a concerted effort to get the ball rolling on that again, and I'm very excited to share this one-on-one interview with UK filmmaker Elliot Hasler, talking about his career, his inspirations, what he's learned along the way, and his latest film, Vindication Swim. I hope you enjoy the episode. Elliot, thank you so much for being here. This is a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. If I understand correctly, you just got back from Toronto, right, TIFF?
I did, yeah. I was at TIFF for a couple of days, yeah. Unfortunately, my film wasn't at TIFF, but maybe next time.
So was it your first time at TIFF?
It was, yeah. I've never been before, but it is great. I mean, it's such an electric atmosphere down there. I think I preferred it to Cannes. I've been to Cannes a few times, and I thought TIFF, I just like the kind of public aspect of it, you know, just people who aren't in the industry can turn up and kind of go along to stuff and things like that, which I just think is, it creates a nice sort of vibe in the area.
Yeah, I've got some friends in the Toronto area who have gone in the past, and a friend of mine who is part of another podcast network actually was sent to TIFF to cover one movie in particular, or at least has covered one so far. So I was just curious what your experience was like. And I'm glad to hear that it does have, you know, a kind of unique energy to it, because that's what I've heard a lot from my friends in Toronto.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I certainly recommend it. I saw the new Bill Nye film there, And Sons, which was a really cool experience to see it in, forget the name of the theater now, but it's like an old one, and it's got these all these murals painted on the walls. So it was a really cool experience.
Awesome. I'm glad you got to experience that. But, you know, you are a young man yourself. You've been making films for, what, a decade now?
Yeah, I mean, not sort of proper films, but yeah. Films as such, yeah. I mean, yeah, so essentially I sort of picked up a camera at about the age of 10 and sort of started making little films, really. And then they've got better and the quality's improved. And then, yeah, here I am with Vindication Swim.
So where does your love for filmmaking come from? I know you said you picked up a camera very young, which sort of I assumed, but what was the thing that drew you to the art form, to the process of filmmaking, and made you say to yourself, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, I always grew up watching a lot of films, and sort of my passion for cinema really began at a very early age. And in terms of the actual sort of making of it, I went to the school I went to when I was about 10 years old. They did this sort of this week in class where instead of regular lessons, everyone just made a film. It was an adaptation of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. It's a very kind of random school thing to do, but it was a fantastic experience. You know, that was my first experience behind a camera and sort of seeing, obviously at a very amateur level, but a level nonetheless, of how films sort of put together and how they're made. And yeah, I sort of fell in love with it from there, really. I mean, I just, you know, absolutely loved that week. And then from then I began making my own little films. And, you know, as I said, the quality kind of improved over time. I made a film called World War II, The Long Road Home, which was about my great grandfather and his experiences as a prisoner of war in Italy during World War II. So I made that between the ages of 14 and 16. And that was kind of my film school, essentially. I never studied film. So I learned a lot making that one. It was a very amateur project, just sort of friends and family in it. We didn't really have professional actors or professional crew or anything, really. And it got picked up for UK, US distribution. And then last year was picked up by Paramount Plus for UK and Europe. And so, yeah, that sort of led me on to Vindication Swim, really. So I'm kind of all self-taught. I've just sort of navigated it myself through trial and error, really.
I mean, that's a huge project to take on as
your first feature to make not only a period piece, but a period war movie. And so I'm curious, you know, given the production requirements for telling a story like that, what did you find most challenging?
All of it, really. I mean, at the age of 14, putting together a film and trying to convince actors to be in it isn't easy in itself, you know, because they think it's going to be terrible. And you know, the film is what it is. Viewed within the context, it's quite good. But obviously, you know, as a movie, you know, at that age, having not studied film and everything, you know, obviously it's certainly a flawed film. But yeah, it was just a big learning curve, really. Kind of everything was new to me on that one. You know, I sort of wore many hats, really, and sort of did it all kind of myself, which I think at the very independent level, you kind of have to do. And then obviously after that, when you've got something to show, you can start bringing people on to head the different departments and cover different roles that you necessarily don't want to cover yourself. So yeah, it certainly was a good stepping stone. And it was nice that kind of then led on to Vindication Swim.
And you acted in that movie as well. So that's a completely sort of different muscle to flex. But I mean, in terms of sort of knowing what you want to bring to the screen and then also being the person that you are directing on camera, is there anything that you took from that you then said, like, this is the lesson that I learned that I really want to bring to my next feature?
Yeah, that I'm a terrible actor. I think that was I was going to skirt around the fact that I was in it, but you put it up. Yeah, that was the takeaway, really. You'll notice I don't appear in Vindication Swim. I was a so that was lesson number one.
Well, you know, credit to you for doing what you needed to do to get the movie done. Vindication Swim is your follow-up feature to that, and it's what, like, 7 years between, I guess, production end dates, but you were working on Vindication Swim for, I think, 3 years, if I read correctly.
Yeah, the filming was 3 years, and then we did post-production for another year after that. So it's sort of a 4-year process, really, to create everything.
And it's a very interesting story. Another period piece. So I've got to ask, it seems like there is some fascination that you have with telling sort of older stories or stories from early 20th century. And, you know, Vindication Swim is a story that is taking place, I think, in 2 years, it'll be a 100-year-old story. So what drew you to this story?
There was a lot of things. I mean, Mercedes Gleitz, who the film is about, we were both born in the same hometown of Brighton on the south coast of England, exactly a century apart. She was born in 1900 and I was born in 2000. So that was kind of a nice synergy right from the outset, really. And then I think sort of a lot of the sort of themes that sort of encompass her as a person, the sort of perseverance, the determination, the resilience, I think on a smaller scale, all of those are sort of things that speak a lot to me as a filmmaker, and certainly a self-taught filmmaker who's making films at an independent level outside of sort of the established industry. I think those traits are, you know, crucial, really. I think a relevance to me there, really. But then there was the challenge of filming out at sea as well. We didn't shoot any of this in tanks or on blue screens or even with body doubles. Everything you see is the real deal. You know, we were out 2 miles into the English Channel with a small crew of people in the water. Kirsten Callahan did all her own swimming. There wasn't a body double. She trained for sort of 3 or 4 months to learn more to swim before we started. And then over the course of that 3 years we were filming, she just carried on training and carried on swimming. So, you know, it was a feat of endurance to make the film as well.
Yeah, there's a couple moments where I really began to ask myself, like, at first I'm like, okay, there's no way you filmed this on the ocean because that's not practical. We've seen movies film on the ocean before, and every director that does it says it's a huge pain in the butt. But then I was like, well, yeah, just the way that the water looks, the way that the skyline looks, it doesn't look like they're filming indoors or in a tank. I don't see any noticeable CGI that would suggest that this is being done any other way. So what was the biggest challenge that you faced heading into the ocean to do this?
Well, I wouldn't say there was any one biggest challenge. Everything was challenging. There was nothing about going out and filming in the sea. You know, I can completely see why filmmakers say it's a pain in the butt, because it is. It's really difficult. But I think it's from that it also is incredibly rewarding, because you go out there sometimes, you know, you'll get maybe one or two shots in the can, and then the winds change, the tide changes, and you have to abandon the shoot and come in. And every time you go out there, it's sort of multiple hours of hanging around on the shore and loading the boat and getting the actors prepped and getting ready to go out. So when you do go out and you've been shooting for like 5 minutes and have to abandon it, you know, it's so demoralizing. And then you've got to come back in. It's more, you know, another few hours to unload the boat. So the undertaking was pretty massive, really. And there were sketchy times out there. You know, the ocean is a dangerous place. And, you know, you really feel the full force of Mother Nature when you're out, you know, in the elements and sort of trying to make a film out there. You know, we had all sorts of different incidents of seasickness, you know, jellyfish. One of the producers was lost out at sea, so there was, you know, different problems really that could have derailed the whole production at any second. It's very, very difficult. There's all sorts of different things you have to contend with.
Did you get the producer back?
We did, yeah, thank you. A storm blew in as we were filming one of the scenes near the end of the film. We needed flat seas with grey sky, which is usually only found sort of in the calm before a storm. So that was, we went out sort of and tried to get everything before the storm hit. We hadn't quite got everything, so we pushed it a little bit further than we should have done. And then that was the only moment in the whole production that we ever sort of let our respect for the channel dip, in a sense. I think we took it for granted a little bit that day, and it gave us a very, very stern warning that, you know, do not disrespect me again, because I can really mess this up for you.
Well, I think there is something that's just very inherently magnetic about when you actually see the ocean on screen. And there was a film recently called Pacifiction, which I think was like a Thai and French production. And there's an amazing scene on the ocean in that film where it just kind of comes out of nowhere. And so for doing something like this and really committing to spending that time on the ocean, it made me think of some other films recently that delved into female swimmers. I mean, we had Naiad within the last few years, Young Woman in the Sea, also telling a kind of similar story, or at least around the same time period. But your film Refugee also, if I'm not mistaken, is a story about somebody crossing the English Channel, just very differently. So was there something specific about the English Channel and the history of it that you are very drawn to?
I think it's partly because I've grown up living on the English Channel sort of my entire life. You know, I'm sort of a few hundred yards from the beach, and, you know, I learned to swim in the English Channel. The English Channel really has been a part of my existence. So I think that's sort of why I was drawn to it, really. You know, I have a sort of deep love for the sea, and to be able to kind of work out there and make this film out there was an incredible experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to keep it close to home and to sort of be inspired by the things that are around you all the time. I want to go back to this being one of several stories that are sort of close in timing that deal with women and swimming challenges in the ocean. What themes do you see in those stories that make for compelling films to be surfacing right now?
I mean, I think all of them are underdog stories. You know, in each of these, the women, the protagonists of the story, they're all doubted and they're all dismissed, and they all go out there and defy all of that and do what they want to do and achieve what they set out to achieve. So I think that is kind of the common thread that ties all of these together. I mean, in terms of why they've all appeared at the same time, I don't know. That was just all coincidence. I mean, you know, we began this back in 2019, and I think Young Woman of the Sea had been in development even earlier than that. And then it just so happened that we all kind of ended up bringing them all out at the same time, which is also kind of, there's been a boom really in open water swimming, in terms of people's interest in it since COVID. And I think all three of these films have really ridden that wave of sort of open water swimming, really, which before COVID, no one really took part in it. It was a very sort of unknown sport. And now I think it's great that all these different films are coming out and celebrating it.
Yeah, it is something that you can safely do outdoors and social distance. That's a good point. I also see it as not just underdog stories, but I think given a lot of the political climate in the world, if you view the ocean as a metaphor for the world, and you have these women that are swimming against current, trying to prove something, I feel like that is sort of like a very prescient theme in all these films as well. And I think something that differentiates your story here is that on the one hand, it is a story of her success in becoming the first British woman to swim across the channel, but also it's kind of a story about, I don't want to say failure because that seems kind of harsh and she didn't really fail, but you know, I watch sports and I do cheer for the underdogs, and there is something about the team or the player, the athlete that reaches the top and then is knocked off the top and then has to reach the top again, because it's hard enough just to do it the one time. But there's something in the character and the spirit of the person that is able to be resilient enough to do it again that I think is, number one, very special. And also, number two, doesn't really get focused on a lot. So in terms of Mercedes herself being the focal point of your story, what about her character was the thing that stood out to you as like, I need to tell this story?
I think it was that, you know, I think that was a very nice point you made about sort of these women swimming upstream, you know, against the current and sort of battling the misogyny and societal sort of expectations placed upon them in the eras in which they're swimming. You know, obviously Mercedes did it in the 1920s, as did Gertrude Edley in Young Women in the Sea. So they were really up against, you know, they're both of German heritage as well. So they had that, the sort of racist aspect of being someone of German heritage in that interwar period, sort of a few years after the First World War. So, you know, there was a lot of things that sort of made this almost impossible, really, for both of those women, and they did defy that. You know, the sort of the whole theme of female empowerment is really a major part of the film, and I think it's interesting you touched upon sort of the idea of failure. I think in life, you know, we have to fail to succeed, and Mercedes really does embody that, because she does fail. I don't want to give too much of the story away here, but you know, she does fail, and it's through that failure that the success comes. I think there's something very, very British in that as well. Actually, it sort of ties in Kirk and that sort of whole glorious failure thing that sort of not necessarily come to define Britain, but I think is sort of a British characteristic.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The idea that you can fail gracefully, like fail in a good way, is something that I think in the era of like American exceptionalism has not been something that really gets the kind of appreciation that it deserves. And I think in any field, whether it's filmmaking, whatever, you do learn more from your failures. I mean, they always say like you learn more from a loss than you do from a win. And so wanting to capture that, I think does pay a lot of respect to the ideas that you're putting forth. But I want to know, in talking with your actress, Kirsten Callahan, about Mercedes, obviously she did the training, like she put in a lot of work to be able to do this film. What did you tell her about Mercedes as a person that you wanted to communicate to the audience?
That's a good question. It's one I've not been asked before. I'm going to have to rack my brain now. So about 5 years ago, we spoke a lot about Mercedes, you know, before we came to it. It was a lot, obviously, about the physical aspect of the role. And, you know, Kirsten was adamant that she wasn't going to have a body double and she was going to do it all herself. And that, you know, she would wear the 1920s bathing suit made of wool and wear the motorcycle goggles and all of that. But then obviously in terms of the character, a lot of it, I think, was there in the script to begin with, which Kirsten, you know, could obviously resonate with. But we did speak in depth about the sort of those themes of perseverance and resilience, and just sort of this notion of Mercedes sort of being, you know, almost like the ocean herself, in that, you know, the tide recedes and then it comes back. You know, you don't get rid of it. It doesn't go away. It keeps on trying and it keeps returning. And that's sort of what Mercedes did. You know, she tried 8 times to swim the English Channel, and she you know, well, she failed 7 times previously, succeeded on the 8th, and then is accused of cheating. And that didn't stop her. She carried on. And after all of that, she became this sort of real trailblazer of not just women's sports, but sports in general. She went all around the world and did these incredible feats of endurance that you know, she was the first person to ever do the Straits of Gibraltar, Robben Island to Cape Town, the Dardanelles. She swam all throughout South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. You know, she went all over the globe and just sort of really proved all the naysayers wrong and went out there and just did what she wanted to do on her terms.
Yeah, I think in my reading about her as a person, her final endurance record was 46 straight hours, and she used to do this in like public pools where people just come and watch and cheer her on as she's swimming for 2 days straight. So it is a particular type of perseverance, and endurance sports definitely require a different level of mentality than it's not a sprint, right? It's a marathon. And the idea that you're always just going to be working and chipping away at the problem is different than, you know, I'm going to train to be the fastest for 10 seconds. And not to say that one is better than the other, but I think it does speak to this particular character. And, you know, the film also ties this into like the labor movement at the time, because she is working as a translator secretary in a like a secretarial pool, and she has to quit her job in order to do this, and she has to get funding to be able to do this. And so to come back as sort of like a working class hero and sort of mix the idea that she is now sort of a celebrity and she's had these dreams of being a celebrity, but also she really represents the working class much more than the elites. Like, how do you navigate those two sides of the story?
I mean, I think having, you know, being British and having grown up in Britain, I think, you know, class is something that, you know, is still intertwined within life here, you know, and certainly in Mercedes' time, she was definitely looked down upon and doubted because she wasn't of the established order. She wasn't this upper class, you know, wealthy person. She was a working class daughter of immigrants, basically, you know, which is sort of in the view of the times is the lowest of the low, really. And she just, you know, ignored all of that. And it was, you know, it obviously is quite complicated to navigate, really, because you have to sort of make sure it's represented, you know, accurately and it's represented well on screen and everything like that. But yeah, I think it's just because her character shines through, it becomes a lot easier to you know, do those scenes, essentially. And Kirsten, obviously, you know, she was really able to embody that and sort of work on the voice, and Mercedes' kind of hesitation with the fame that she gets from it. You know, Kirsten brought all that to the role as well, which you know, I thought was a lovely touch, because Mercedes, she'd speak about how uncomfortable she was with the fame. You know, she never did it for that reason. She did it for a love of the water, and the fame was sort of a byproduct of that, an uncomfortable byproduct for her, really.
Yeah, and I found that to be sort of like the interesting through line of her character, in that she kind of has these aspirations of that fame, but also just is not cut from that cloth, and it's thrust upon her in a way that she didn't really want, and then it's brought under the microscope in a way that she didn't deserve. So it's a very complex character, and I think Kirsten does a very good job in that lead role, because so much of, I think, the story is on her shoulders. But I want to ask you about another actor, and that's John Locke, who you seem to have developed a pretty good relationship with.
Yeah, no, John and I get on. I mean, I got on with everyone on the film. You know, Kirsten and I are very close as well. But obviously with John, I've worked with him before on, we did a short film together. And then, yeah, I was able to bring him on this as the coach. And, you know, John's fantastic to have on board. You know, he's sort of a big champion of independent film. He's done all the big Oscar nominated movies, Darkest Hour, The Favourite. He was in Poor Things recently. And then, yeah, so to have him, you know, come on board this one and kind of give it a nice level of prestige was brilliant.
Well, with making, what was it? The Mayer Diaries, right? That's a documentary. It's a different muscle to flex. You're doing that after you've done your first short, after you've done your first feature. Did you take anything away from that experience that helped you frame how you wanted to tell this story?
I think what was helpful with that, having done sort of a documentary and experienced the workings of that, is everything moves so quickly. You know, as a filmmaker on a documentary, you have to be reactive. You know, you're not staging the shots. You're sort of reacting to what's going around you and trying to capture everything in sort of the best way that you can. And when you're out in the sea, you know, this is, it works in much the same way. You can line it up, but then the waves are going to come in and knock it out kilter. And, you know, the wind is going to blow the actor's hat off or whatever. And you've got to be ready with the camera, and you just got to be shooting as much footage as you can and be sort of as quick and as light on your feet as you can. So I think that experience doing that documentary was definitely very helpful in then coming out and filming at sea, because yeah, everything is so fast paced out there.
And I imagine having to get all the footage that you can get while you can get it due to sort of like environmental restrictions puts you in a different position when the film is being edited. So how involved are you in the editing process, and what was it like to edit this movie in particular?
I mean, this one was a mammoth to edit. I mean, I was involved, you know, very heavily in it, and it was a challenge. You know, there was a lot of footage that we shot out there. We shot tons and tons of footage, just as much as we could capture, really. And, you know, a great deal of it ended up on the cutting room floor, you know, as is kind of inevitable when you shoot so much. I think the first cut of the film came in at about 3.5 hours, and then we whittled it down to sort of 90 minutes.
Do you, in your head, when you're thinking of the movie, do you have like a pre-existing limit? Do you want to keep it around 90 minutes? Like, I think Hitchcock was the one who was like, we need to keep movies at this length for the audience sake. So do you feel like you want to always do that?
I think there's different factors that come into the length, deciding on the length of a film. I mean, you know, I think this story lends itself to kind of a nice tight 90 minute runtime. Other films, you know, I'm a big fan of Lawrence of Arabia. You know, obviously that's an incredibly long film, you know, it's pushing 4 hours. But obviously, you know, in an independent level as well, having it shorter is going to be helpful getting it into theaters and that sort of thing. They're reluctant to program a film that's 3.5 hours long just because it means that their program is a lot shorter that day. They can only maybe slot in sort of one or two other films. Whereas if it's 90 minutes, you know, it's a quick in and out kind of showing for them. They can slot other movies in as well. So there is sort of a practical reason why it was shorter in length as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Digestibility, I think, is important. But are you someone that feels like the movie should be as long as it is supposed to be? Or do you look at like a certain length of time as sort of like the ideal sweet spot? Because like you said, you're a fan of long movies. There are some very good long films that sort of make sense to be that long.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to the story you're trying to tell at the end of the day. I don't think you should ever, you know, make your film 3.5 hours because you want it to be sort of this self-indulgent thing, or equally 90 minutes just so you can program it in a few more theaters. You know, I think it needs to be the length that the story deserves. And I think that's sort of what I aspire to with these films, you know, to get it to that sort of optimal length, really.
Makes sense. And I think working with short films gives you a good sort of, I wouldn't say starting point, but it gives you a good sort of like practical application for beginning, middle, end. And we're doing this on a much shorter scale. So you've made several short films at this point. What is the biggest takeaway that you've learned from making short films and then making the jump and doing this film?
I think the biggest thing really, you know, sort of as an independent filmmaker that I picked up from short films, is to view a feature as sort of a series of short films. You know, with a short, you've got maybe sort of a few scenes in it. And you know, with a feature, I kind of just view it as sort of an extended short film. Each time you're going out and shooting a scene, I sort of view it as if it is a short film. You know, each scene needs to kind of have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you kind of approach it with that mindset. I think a lot of filmmakers I speak to are sort of daunted by the idea of going and making a feature length film. But if you split it up into sort of a series of short films that all have this sort of thread that goes through them and it all ties together, you know, as a feature, then I think it becomes a lot more manageable, really, because filmmakers, they'll make sort of 6-7 short movies. And I sort of do think, well, why not have just sort of pooled all those resources into one and turned that into a feature? I mean, that's my thinking with it.
No, that's an interesting way to look at it, because I've talked to some other filmmakers that have made shorts and are looking to now make full length features, and sort of the planning and the ideation that goes into the two are very different. So that's a very interesting way to look at it. what stage of post-production are you at with Vindication Swim? I know the movie's done because I watched it, but are you looking for global distribution? I think this debuted in the UK already, right?
Yeah, so we finished post-production a couple of years ago now, and then we released in the UK last March. Theatrically, we were expecting 1 or 2 weeks in cinemas, and we ended up having this sort of 18-week huge run of the film. You know, it was really kind of lapped up by the public beyond what, you know, how we were over it kind of expecting. And yeah, it did incredibly well. And now off the back of that, we've got it coming out in North America this October. So it will open in New York on October 17th, followed by the week after. We got San Francisco, Toronto. We're sort of all over, really. And we're doing sort of a Q&A tour around the States, a little bit of Canada as well.
Oh, awesome. When it comes to LA, I'll have to keep an eye out and see if you're at the Q&A. Maybe I'll be able to make it.
Yeah, I'll be there. So the Mel Royal in where is that? Santa Monica Boulevard, I think.
Okay, that's not too far. I can make that happen. So in terms of this film's success and what the future looks like, I see that there is something that you have that is listed as sort of like in production or maybe in pre-production.
Yeah, so we've got a few films. They're all kind of in various stages of pre-production. One's sort of a true crime thriller set in the 1930s. Another one is a First World War film, so again, based on a true story. So yeah, there's a number of kind of films that I'm working on at the moment, but all kind of do tie in again with sort of this historical true story basis.
Yeah, you do seem to have a fascination with history and exploration and sort of tying those themes into a contemporary age. Do you feel like you're just an old soul in that way? Or is there something about like history specifically that you really feel matters right now in a contemporary world?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, one of the reasons I like doing old sort of period pieces is when you walk on set and there's kind of all these old cars and everyone's in costume and all that, it does feel like you've been transported back in time. You know, that is quite a cool experience. But, you know, I think more importantly than that, I think history does have a lot of relevance to the world today and the way we operate, the way we live. You know, all of that is tied into our past. And I think exploring kind of modern themes and that sort of thing through these old stories, I think, you know, you end up with something very interesting from that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There's that saying that, you know, history repeats itself. So if we don't learn from the lessons of the past, we're doomed to repeat them in the future. That sort of notion. But, you know, as I read about you in preparation for this, I saw a couple of phrases that got tossed around a lot. And I want to ask you about that, because the two that were most prominent were UK's youngest filmmaker and the UK's Spielberg are often thrown around quite a bit as descriptors. And well, I'm sure the comparison is, of course, flattering. It seems like that's got to come with a lot of pressure. So how do you handle that comparison?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, you know, it's very flattering. I love Steven Spielberg, and Jaws was a huge inspiration behind Vindication Swim. Even the poster is kind of bears a slightly Jaws-esque. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's lovely to kind of have that comparison. I've never really thought too deeply about it. And, you know, it certainly never felt like it's pressured me in any sense, really. You know, I kind of, you know, take it in my stride, really. It's a nice badge to have, and I'm, you know, kind of grateful I was given it. The UK's youngest film director one, I'm not as keen on that one. I mean, it's kind of, I feel it's a bit sort of pigeonholing, in a box as being like, oh, this is a young filmmaker. I'd rather just be a filmmaker. You know, I don't need the young sort of caveat added onto it.
Yeah, that was sort of my follow-up question, was like, how do you view yourself as a filmmaker? Because I would imagine that, like, well, number one, just mathematically, sooner or later, you're not going to be the youngest UK filmmaker anymore. But number two, it does sort of, I don't know, it sort of frames you as like and I guess in the States, we call it like an attaboy, like, oh, good job. You know, it sort of diminishes you as a filmmaker by always quantifying it as, oh, you're the youngest filmmaker. So congrats for doing it at such a young age. Like, I think regardless of that, you're doing it. You're doing what you want to do. You're making the features you want to make. You were just at an international film festival. So how do you view yourself as a filmmaker?
Certainly not as a young one. I just am young. genetics and science. So I just view myself as a filmmaker. Yeah, that's sort of where it begins and ends, really.
How old are you exactly?
25 now.
Okay. So yeah, you're getting a lot of stuff done at a fairly young age, but I mean, congratulations to you for putting in the work and getting it done. I know a lot of people that are going to listen to this interview are interested in the process of filmmaking. I'm sure there's a handful of them that are aspiring filmmakers as well. And so for people that haven't made something, for people that want to make something, given all of your experience at this point, what would be the biggest piece of advice that you could give to people looking to make their first project, whether that be a feature or a short film?
I think my advice would tie back to the point about the short films is I would not advise people to go and make sort of, you know, a series of short films. I would say go and try and make a low budget feature instead of a short. I think one, you can monetize that. So, you know, you can get it released, you can get it distributed, and then you have money coming in, which can then help you go on to make other stuff as well, which with a short film, you just can't do. You know, you can get them shown at festivals and that sort of thing, but you're never going to actually be able to profit from a short film. Whereas with a feature, you know, you can make money, you can release it, and then you can promote it and all that sort of thing. And I just think it sets you in better stead, you know, aside from a monetary aspect, having to navigate an entire sort of 90-minute production and make sure it's legible and make sure it flows and that you have characters in there and a storyline and everything like that. I think it just sets you in far better stead and kind of puts you separate from the crowd, if you like, if you've attempted that, as opposed to just doing sort of a short film and going through the motions like sort of the bulk of new filmmakers do.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hope that there is someone out there that's going to listen to that and really take that advice. I also want to ask you, because you have written all of this stuff as well. So from, I guess, idea to pen to paper to execution, what do you bring into the script writing process that helps you the most when you're making the film itself?
I think essentially it sort of ties back to that idea of, you know, a film being made three times. I sort of, with each film I've done, it's kind of has been made three times. When I've written it and put it down onto paper, and then again when we're shooting it, and then finally in the edit, you know, you sort of, they're three different films, and what you end up with in the edit is still obviously bears a great resemblance to the written word, but it's sort of completely different to your mind's eye and sort of how you expected it to look. You know, everything changes, especially being out at sea on this one. You know, very little of it was exactly how I envisioned it was going to be. Mm. You know, whether that's sort of for better or for worse, you know, who am I to say, really? But it's certainly, yeah, I enjoy the writing aspect and sort of the idea of kind of building worlds and then getting to shepherd that all the way through to the completion. You know, it's certainly it's a fantastic experience. It makes it harder to let go because sort of your baby by that point, you know, you've been carrying it around for sort of 3 years, you know, with the script and then getting it made and all of that. But no, I do love kind of being involved in all aspects of filmmaking.
Well, that's good to hear. Has there been any like big sacrifices where you put something on the page and you're very committed to it and believed in it, and then by the time you get to shooting it, you're like, oh, this just is not gonna happen?
I haven't actually had an experience that, I mean, there's been scenes that we've cut and, you know, yeah, some scenes they don't quite come together, and nothing sort of devastating really. I mean, I work with a script consultant who's fantastic, and we spend a lot of time going over the script and going over the scenes, and if anything sort of does feel sort of superfluous really, then we'll drop it from the script to avoid having those scenarios where you're on set and it's not coming together, because there's nothing worse than that. You know, that is pretty awful. I kind of view the script essentially as kind of like a recipe. You know, you've got the written recipe there, and then the cooking, you know, of the ingredients is sort of your time on set, essentially. So if the recipe's sound, then what you're cooking will end up, you know, hopefully tasting pretty good.
It's a good analogy. I like that. How many drafts do you typically do with a script before you feel like you're finished?
I think I have to kind of lose count before I feel like I've finished. I think that's the best way of describing it, really. You know, scripts, you just constant rewriting. You've got to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, and eventually you will get there. I think the way I kind of like to do it is sort of to do the plot first and sort of plot everything out, and then sort of begin the character work of giving them personalities and fleshing them out and making them real.
With sort of the translation or the taking what's on the page and putting it on the screen, I imagine there's moments that creep up for yourself where there is doubt. So how do you handle self-doubt? Do you just power straight through it? Do you stop and internalize that and really see, you know, maybe I was wrong about this? Or do you just plow it down with confidence?
I tend to try and plow it down as much. Obviously, you know, you do need to be self-critical, I think, as a filmmaker. So obviously there is an element of that too. But you know, I think what led to Vindication Swim being made was a sort of this idea of powering through and this sort of naivety, really, on behalf of me and almost everyone else involved, really. I think if we'd sat down and thought too deeply about the actual practicalities of going out and making a film like this, it never would have happened. You know, you would overthink it and it would all become too much. We just didn't really do that. We thought, you know, we were capable of doing it, and we went out and we just figured out ways of making it happen. You know, that is sort of what independent filmmaking is. You know, it's a myriad of different problems, and you have to kind of figure out a creative solution to each of them.
Yeah, I do kind of appreciate looking at it as like, it's like an engineering problem in a way, in that there is always going to be a problem that pops up, and how you solve it, I think, is going to say a lot about you as the director, and then it'll translate into the production itself. So I'm curious, what have you learned the most from your experience in filmmaking so far that you're looking to, you know, bring into your next project?
That's a good question. I think I've learned sort of, well, a lot from doing these films, really. I don't know if I have sort of a direct answer to that. I think obviously the script is very important, and sort of nailing the script to begin with, because then that does solve problems later down the line. I mean, you know, we had sort of issues on my previous films where, you know, maybe certain acts haven't been quite as tight as they ought to have been, and they sort of had to be fixed in post, and then you had to, you know, we had to kind of shoot a little bits around it and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think if you have nailed the script and you've got the script, you know, as sort of watertight as possible, then it will make your journey into production and into the edit, you know, a lot easier. But also planning. I mean, planning is key. I would never want to go into a shoot having sort of winged the preparation of it. You know, you do need all of the sort of, you know, not necessarily shots mapped out, but you need to kind of know how you want to light it, how you want to shoot it, you know, where you want the actors to be, the blocking. You know, I think rehearsals are quite good with the actors. Obviously not too many that you ruin the spontaneity of the performance, but enough that it makes it a bit easier on the day.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about rehearsals, because I know there's some filmmakers that are very rehearsal heavy. So that way, by the time that you just start rolling, everybody knows what they're supposed to do. You sort of fleshed out a lot of the rough edges. But in terms of not wanting to lose the spontaneity, I think that is an interesting thread. And I'm curious, when you're working with actors, because obviously you directed yourself, so it's sort of like a straight line translation from your brain into your brain. But when you're talking to an actor or anybody else in the cast, how flexible are you with them in terms of wanting their input on how they read the character? Like, how much do you adhere to the script in any given situation?
The point about sort of directing yourself, I think for the most part, it doesn't work. I think there has to be a form of collaboration and a different minds meeting. I mean, there's very few people who can pull off an acting and directing gig in one go. I mean, Clint Eastwood, you know, is probably one of the very few that can do that and do it very well. You know, so yeah, I mean, I like to collaborate with the actors. I like them to bring their own ideas to the table. You know, sometimes stuff won't work, or we'll disagree about what it is, but I think it's always best to try it and give it a go and hash it out. And then if it doesn't work, then you can revert to sort of your original idea. But I think there needs to be a trust between the actor and director of, you know, there is room for collaboration here. It's not going to be me being sort of dictatorial and barking orders and demands at you for the scene. You know, it needs to be organic. It needs to feel real. And, you know, I think if the actor is trying to be too rigid and just following what someone else's view of the character should be, then it's going to sort of reflect that on screen. Whereas if they're kind of given the freedom, I mean, some of the greatest characters of all time, you know, are come out of sort of an actor taking a role that was otherwise quite constrained, and they've gone and given it this sort of flair. I mean, you know, Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow is a prime example of that. You know, something like that. He really brought his own sort of creativity to the role, which had the director been very arbitrary, would never have made it to the screen.
Yeah, that's a good point. How much time do you spend with your cast before you actually start principal photography? Is it a lot of table reads, a lot of going back and forth? Like, do you sort of cultivate that environment before you get to set or location?
On Vindicated Swim, we didn't actually do that much. I think it was just such a baptism of fire on that one, being out, the first shot, the first thing we did was out at sea. So, you know, I think we just got to know everybody very well, very quickly. So there was, you know, there was sort of automatically a level of trust when you're helping an actor down into a boat, and, you know, if he falls, he's gonna like probably sink under the water. So I think that the trust, you know, came about pretty naturally on that one. On the next one, I think we'll look at doing some sort of earlier table reads and stuff like that, just because of the nature of the film, I think, lends itself more to that sort of, you know, dynamic. But on this one, you know, because it was so long, everyone became very attuned with how each other works. And we all became very, very close because we were together for sort of 3 years. It was almost like a family.
Yeah, that is a long time to be working together. And I mean, number one, I don't imagine that you're going to be shooting on the ocean again anytime soon. But in terms of, you know, the relationships that you made with the cast and the crew working on this film, do you already have, you know, projects lined up with some of the people that you worked on Vindication Swim with?
Yeah, I mean, Kirsten and I have co-written a script. So there's, you know, there's a relationship there. And obviously, you know, my relationship with John is very good as well. You know, Victoria, all of the kind of principals, you know, I mean, it was great working with them on this film. And, you know, I'd certainly be keen to work with them again, for sure.
And I see also that, you know, you've served as the producer on a couple of things. You've done cinematography on a couple of your projects as well. You know, you've worn a lot of the different hats, which sort of on the one hand is necessity, but on the other hand, you gain the experience from doing that. Is there a particular element in the process that you really enjoy doing that you haven't really had the opportunity to do a lot of, that you would like to do more of?
No, not really. I think I've had to take on sort of too many hats that I'm ready to get rid of some. It's more that way around. You know, as much as I do enjoy the cinematography aspect of it, I think that's something I'll maybe look to pass the hat to someone else for the next one, just because it gives me more time with the actors and stuff, you know, because I shot Vindication Swim, so I was sort of, you know, spent the best part of 3 years bobbing around in the English Channel trying to make sure that the horizon was straight. But so for the next one, I think, you know, I'll give a few of those roles away. You know, I've sort of been very involved in the costuming of this one as well. And, you know, that's a role that I would sort of happily let go. Same with a few others as well. So, I mean, I think it's important to have done them because I know how they work, and I'm not going to be sort of, you know, and getting people to do things that I have no concept of how it works. So it's a kind of nice to have that understanding and then to be able to work with someone and, you know, do it in that capacity.
Yeah, I spoke to a Scottish filmmaker, and that was for my other show. But, you know, we were joking a little bit that in terms of him being the director, he's sort of allowed himself to become the suggester in that, yeah, he's directing, but he likes to sort of suggest a lot of things and then have that be a collaborative experience. And it sounds like you're really into the collaboration side of things as well. And in fact, if I read or if I understood correctly, there sort of cannot be the creative process without the collaborative experience. So for, I guess, people that are looking to maybe get something made, whether that be a script idea, if they're looking to start directing something, what would you tell them about that collaboration that has value?
I mean, I think collaboration is just essential. You know, you need to pick a great team and you need to have a shared vision that aligns. You know, I think it's difficult when you're working with people who have different motives and different views of how they think it should turn out. I think you have to pick your team very wisely. You know, Vindication Swim, if we hadn't been aligned kind of in our shared desire to kind of celebrate this story of Mercedes Gleitz and tell it in the way we wanted to tell it, I think it would have been a very difficult 3 years. You know, it would have been a loggerheads constantly. And I think the end product would have reflected that. But, you know, as it stands, we had, you know, great people working on it. And we all just really, you know, had this passion for the story and desire to tell it. You know, that was sort of what it was all about. So I think picking your team wisely and then collaborating with them is, you know, crucial. And I think also being aware of when not to collaborate as well. You know, if you haven't got an aligned vision, then I think, you know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with the director. As much as a producer might want to argue the point on that one, I think that's where it stops. So, you know, I think, you know, don't be afraid to stand your ground when you need to. But obviously collaboration, you know, is great as well.
Have you run into instances where the producer has a different idea than you and you're pretty steadfast on the script?
Not on Vindication Swim. No, that was, it was just a lovely team really. You know, we had fantastic producers, who didn't really get too involved in the creative side of it, which was quite nice really. It was sort of, they, you know, that they sort of let me get on with that. And then they handled the stuff outside of the creative aspects of it, which I think is sort of the best way of sort of a direct producer relationship.
Yeah, I think like organizationally, I find the film process and the production side of things interesting because it's not entirely dissimilar from other work environments in terms of like you have leadership, you have decided roles, you know, it's not entirely foreign. But I think for a lot of people who watch films and enjoy films, it does sort of feel like it is this kind of like just magical thing that is happening. And I think for me as a fan, the collaboration is what makes it as fascinating as it is, because it requires so many people to make this one thing. And there are so many different art forms coming together to make this one sort of very unique art form that encompasses all of these different things. So do you sort of look at it like you're going to work, or, you know, there's that saying, like, if you find the thing that you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Do you feel like you're working?
When it's stressful, yeah. Then but no, for the most part, you know, I absolutely love it. I don't think if I didn't, I don't think I would want to pursue it as a career, because, you know, it's not the easiest one to do. And, you know, it's hard to make a decent living. And, you know, it's a difficult one to navigate. So I think unless you have an absolute passion, an absolute love of film and filmmaking, then yeah, just get into another industry, really. But it is an interesting one, how it sort of does blend all the different art forms. Like you said, I don't think it gets kind of enough appreciation of that, really, because, you know, you've got the performing arts with the actors, you've got the sort of photography, you've got architecture with designing the sets, you've got music. You know, it really does encompass every single art form as one, you know, the written word with the script. I don't think there's anything else out there that is quite so all encompassing as film, which, you know, I think adds to the magic of it, really.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that sort of gets movies to this place of magic that a lot of people around the world can sort of, like, we all look towards movies as this sort of like this pinnacle. And I think that's part of the reason why. And I want to ask you a question that I haven't asked any of the other filmmakers that I've interviewed so far. And I want to ask you about AI and its sort of inevitable place in the business. It seems like it is on an unavoidable trajectory. I mean, I know personally there's a independent filmmaker who, like, he's been making independent films for a long time, lots of shorts, has made a couple features, and then all of a sudden in the last maybe year has pivoted completely to sort of like a very salesmanship kind of approach and is now kind of promoting the use of AI and talking about its inevitability. And it seems to be like sort of a collision course between like analog filmmaking, I'm going to call it, because I have to now. And what is inevitably going to be artificial intelligence really having a prominent role in the business. I'm just curious, like, how do you view the future of filmmaking? Because you still have the vast majority of your filmmaking career ahead of you.
I mean, I think AI is great so long as it remains sort of a tool and isn't the driving force behind everything that you do. I mean, you know, it can do a lot. It can be incredibly helpful, you know, for everything from sort of refining sort of what you've written. If you have a bit of writer's block or whatever, you know, AI can be a great tool in sort of unlocking the potential, I think, is sort of the best way of looking at it. And even right down to the other end of sort of, it can save you a load of costs on films as well. You know, there's people who sort of use AI in lieu of a lawyer these days and stuff like that. So you know, I think as sort of a money saving tool, it's quite helpful. And also as sort of a way of sort of refining your work and using it as a tool to kind of get better results. I don't have an issue with it in that sense. I think when it gets a bit dangerous is when it's sort of replacing actors, and there's sort of all ethical issues behind sort of actors being recreated with AI and then changing what they're saying and putting them in different scenarios and that sort of thing. I think that's where it gets dangerous. And I think the only one that I think is sort of is sadly inevitable is sort of with visual effects. I just don't see I have visual effect designers in the same way in the next, well, maybe even 10 years, you know, with the way that AI is going and how you can sort of create, you know, all sorts of different things, aliens and explosions and spaceships and all that kind of stuff, you know, just with a few words on a keyboard. I do think, sadly, that will get to a point where visual effects, you know, it's expensive. And I think AI will kind of unfortunately make that redundant. When that will be, you know, I don't know. But I think that is probably going to be one of the first casualties of AI. But I think, you know, used in the correct way, it does have the potential to also be, you know, a very useful tool.
Well, there was this, I don't know if you've seen it in the UK, but the AI Wizard of Oz experience that they did.
Oh, the Vegas Sphere.
Yeah, right. So it's like the cutting edge of technology in that, like, when the tornado's on screen, there's stuff flying all around the building. I'm like, well, I don't know that I want to get hit in the face with garbage while I'm watching the movie, but I understand a little bit of the ideation and taking something like that and really sort of blowing it up. But this was kind of like a hard line in the sand, as David Zaslav, the president of Warner Brothers, like, had his face digitally inserted into the movie, I think was the rumor. And so, you know, hardcore film fans are like, this is a monstrosity. It should not exist. And then I think the casual moviegoer that isn't paying attention to, like, what is happening in the artistry space with AI is a lot more apt to go and experience something like that and not really see that the line has been sort of already crossed at that point. Like, we're already over the threshold. But I feel like AI has some, like, I've always been very fascinated by it. You know, I grew up watching a lot of science fiction stories, and some of my favorite science fiction stories involve artificial intelligence. And I feel like what we have now is more generative, you know, AI use. So it's more like prompt based. Let me reference a bunch of different things and create a model versus like a thinking AI. So those are sort of like two different things. But for people that fear AI sort of replacing filmmakers or making it so that anybody with a keyboard can like type some words and their movie gets made, I want to reassure them that I've seen movies that were made as like full AI creations, and they're not good. Because I think the thing for me is that having the ability to do something is not the same thing as having the drive and the passion and the will to do something. And in your experience, you had to, like, you filmed this movie on the ocean, like, just for the sake of authenticity, right? Like, that's not something that AI is going to be able to replicate. So do you have any fear that there's going to be a market for stuff that is made solely like on kind of like a cheap prompt based model?
I think it's not in its entirety is sort of what I'm trying to say. I don't think, you know, there'll be a film where someone's just sort of like gives it a prompt and it comes up with a film. I think, you know, you're always going to need kind of human artistry in the script phase. You know, I've sort of experimented with AI just to see what it can do and sort of asked it to write, you know, a scene for a film or whatever. And the stuff it comes out with, you know, as you say, is terrible. It's incredibly generic. You know, there's nothing interesting or there's no real kind of underlying themes that are interesting. It's just slop, really. Which, you know, I don't see how it can ever really get that capable in the sense of like how a human brain come up with a story. And, you know, AI is not going to become Shakespeare, you know, do you know what I mean? So I think there's always going to have to be a human element involved somewhere, whether that's in the writing stage. And then, you know, they use AI to animate the movie or something like that. I don't know. But again, I think the human eye is very, you know, sort of good at picking out things that are fake, things that aren't real. You know, audiences can tell even when it's CGI, they can tell when you're faking it, they can tell when it's not real, which, you know, was another reason why we shot this in the English channel. It immerses the audience in there. It becomes real on screen. And, you know, that's something that AI, no matter how good it gets, I think the human eye is always going to be able to kind of have that discernibility of knowing that it's not real.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think for me personally, like the point of art is the humanity of it. So if you're shortcutting the humanity, then your art doesn't have a point. If your art doesn't have a point, then like literally what is the point? So I'm not like overly afraid, but I was just curious because I had never really like spoken to a filmmaker about like what the horizon looks like with all this stuff coming, and basically these sort of models getting better and better and better every day. But you know, let's get back to Vindication Swim. You have this, you know, release plotted for all of the next, what, few months?
So it's sort of, yeah, across October and November. Yeah.
So you're going to be touring with this?
Yeah, I will be. Yeah. So I'll be in New York sort of from the middle of October. And then, yeah, following it all the way through East Coast, West Coast, a bit of Canada as well.
Awesome. Well, I am going to, if you end up in the LA Q&A, I will work to make sure that I get myself there.
That'd be great to see you there. I'll definitely be there. You know, I'll be in LA. I'll be doing as many Q&A screenings as possible. I love going out and meeting the audiences and, you know, engaging with them after the film. So yeah, I'll definitely be there.
Awesome. Sounds good. Do you have any closing statements that you wanted to make about the film itself or about like what you're hoping to do in the future?
Not particularly. No, I mean, just go and see the film. It's my closing statement.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. This has been a fascinating interview. I appreciate you indulging some of my odd questions, but I think it makes for a more fun environment.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's nice to get some more questions that aren't, you know, the same kind of questions every time. It was cool chatting about AI and all that sort of stuff, for sure.
Thank you so much. I wish you the best of luck with Vindication Swim, and I hope to see you in Los Angeles.
Thanks very much. Yeah, hopefully see you in LA soon.
A huge thank you to Elliot for coming on the show and letting me chew his ear a little bit about not just his upcoming project, but a lot of different things within the film business and his particular experiences within that. Vindication Swim makes its U.S. debut this week, and Elliot is going to be at some of those screenings in New York and Los Angeles, so if you get the opportunity to check one of those out, make sure that you do it. Elliot's a really nice guy, and he's happy to answer any of the questions that you bring his way. And I will make sure to put up the links to his socials in the show notes, so that way everything is just one click away for you. On a personal note, I am trying to get back on track with This Week at the Movies, but if you like hearing me talk movies and you missed that show, check out Bad Movies We Love, part of the Scheist Podcast Network. And until next time, take care, everybody.